Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Don't touch that teapot,
4-year-old Miranda warned her mom, who was putting away the dishes.
Beautiful Belinda lives there, and right now she's sleeping.
Her mom nearly dropped her coffee cup, but managed a quizzical smile. Oh? She looked at her daughter. And what does beautiful Belinda do when she's not sleeping?
She flies around, of course, Miranda replied earnestly. She likes the living room window and the violet plants, because she likes purple. But mostly, she likes teapots, because, she paused for dramatic effect, every day, she has a tea party.
Gee, Miranda's dad poked his head around the doorway. May I come? Miranda studied him with great seriousness.
Only if you promise to be careful where you sit.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about children's imaginary friends? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has visited with Parents' Perspective before, and he knows a lot about children and their imaginary worlds. Dr. Mark Nemiroff is a noted child psychologist, author, professor, and speaker on children's issues. He has a private practice in Maryland and is on the faculty of the Washington School of Psychiatry. He's also affiliated with the Baltimore District of Columbia Society for Psychoanalysis and is a fellow of the American Orthopsychiatric Association. Dr. Nemiroff has written a number of books for children addressing issues we are all familiar with, including All About Adoption and Sometimes I'm Scared, both with Jane Annunziata, and The Very Lonely Bathtub with Anne Rasmussen. Every year, Dr. Nemiroff spends a month in Bombay as a volunteer working with slum and street children. He is the father of one grown son. Welcome back to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Nemiroff.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
On a whole different issue this time, what's the biggest adult misconception about children's imaginary friends?
This is my shortest answer. The misconception is that it's a problem.
That's terrific.
Or that it's unusual, because it's not a problem and it's not unusual. 2/3 of all children ages 2 to 7 and beyond have them, and often more than one. More than one at the same time,
oh,
yes.
Oh, my goodness, a whole group.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Why do children have imaginary friends? You think of the lonely onlys who need a playmate, but my guess is that there's more to it than that.
It's often not the onlys who have
the imaginary friends.
There are several reasons. The first is simply that it's fun. And it's creative. One English girl had decided that the Prince of Wales was actually a whale. And she's going to marry the Prince of Wales so they could have whaledren. And she would know exactly how to raise the whaledren, which would be in a palace.
A wet palace.
Now, that would be, and they would all live in the bathtub, which would be very big. And what fun. And it's creative. Some imaginary friends are objects, animated objects. I'll tell you about one later. Imaginary friends help children make sense of their lives, like practicing loss when they kill one off or they send one away on a trip. Oh, he died is often how children, imaginary friends, go away.
Does that help?
It's a matter of, I no longer need my imaginary friend, and so I'm several years older now. So, oh, she died. She moved to California or something like that. So, but they're really practicing what it's like to say goodbye and to lose someone.
What about the ones who are nasty or annoying, the imaginary friends who aren't so lovely? You wouldn't really want to invite them in.
They die sooner.
Well, there are different types. I was thinking about this, and I came up with 5 different types of imaginary friends. There's your twin, perhaps in a whimsical form. One little girl I saw was, her imaginary friend was Big Bird, only she was often Big Bird, and you had to call her Bird. And when she was Bird, she had her own imaginary friend, who's Mr. Snuffleupagus. So the imaginary friend had an imaginary friend. And that one was simply just like her. There's also the alter ego, who represents the opposite characteristics that the child shows to the world. And here, they can be mischievous, they can have superpowers, they can be mean. There's the role model. This is the most common one. A role model, like an imaginary superhero who's going to save the world, who has some extraordinary power, and he gets it from eating potato chips, which he's not allowed to eat at home. There's the scapegoat, the one who gets in trouble. My godson had a purple dinosaur, and whenever he would make a mess, he would put the purple dinosaur in the room. He would talk to the dinosaur. The dinosaur was real. He would put it in the middle of the room. The dinosaur's name was Bernice. And whenever he would get in trouble, his mother would come in and he would just say, "Bernice did it." And then there's the confidant.
That's interesting. There was a movie a number of years ago about a little boy, and there was a dinosaur who only showed up because the little boy had troubles in his family.
Yes.
And that was kind of interesting because it was very poignant that this imaginary creature was there to help him in time of trouble.
Right. The one that we all know is Hobbes, from Calvin and Hobbes. And Hobbes is a confidant. When Calvin feels misunderstood by his parents, he turns to Hobbes, who's no longer a stuffed tiger but becomes a real tiger, and fills him in. And even though that's no longer being written, the kids today still collect Calvin and Hobbes books, and they read them, and they're fascinated by this.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on imaginary friends.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Mark Nemiroff about imaginary friends.
As a professional, would you say that the role of the confidant solves a problem for some children who can't talk about things otherwise?
Yes. Because just the act of talking is tension releasing, mm-hmm. and that which allows the child to think through and then move on. I can come back, Sandy, to your question about why some of imaginary friends would be nasty to their hosts, because the imaginary friends often are a personalization of unacceptable feelings of the child, usually aggressive feelings. And so child feels uncomfortable being angry, so he puts it onto the imaginary friend, who then punishes him for being angry, because the imaginary friend is still part of him. But there's a plus side, because that scenario can also be used for developing empathy in trying to figure out, like a bully, we'll sometimes have an imaginary friend who's nasty to him. And from there, he can figure out through empathy what it might feel like to be pushed around.
How do we find out if a child has an imaginary friend,
if they're not having a tea party?
Right, if they're not having a tea party.
Sometimes, actually, usually they'll tell you, okay. Or you'll overhear them, or if an object is a real object, is sometimes more animated than you thought, you'll hear it in sometimes in conversation. There was one youngster who had a boy doll, large boy doll that was almost as big as he was. He was about 3 1/2. And he was taking the boy doll to Disney World with his parents, and he wanted them to buy a separate ticket for a separate seat. And so the parents asked, "How come?" He said, "So he can talk to the person next to him." I said, "Well, what would he tell them?" He would tell them about how he lives on a separate planet that's under the bed, to how he's allowed to drink sodas and have potato chips, which he's not allowed to have at home, and how he's really worried about what happens to the animals in the zoo when it's cold. And that's how they found out that this person was alive. This doll was alive.
Why?
How are make-believe companions beneficial to the children, and can they be detrimental?
They're beneficial because they're pure entertainment, and if they'll let you in, you'll have a wonderful time. Imaginary friends are really about 95% wonderful. There are some problems, and I'll mention them later, but mostly they're wonderful, and they're fun. They help children develop theories of how the world works. My son was trying to figure out about the leaves in the fall and the leaves in the spring and how the two are so different. And he had a vacuum cleaner named Sweeper that was alive. And he decided that what happens is where the leaves go, the leaves are all picked up by Sweeper from all the lawns, and they're deposited in the zoo long enough for all the animals, especially the monkeys and the orangutans, to play with them until it gets too cold. And then Sweeper takes all the leaves and brings them up into the sky to God, who makes them soft and paints them green and puts them back on the trees in the spring. Does it make sense? No. But the creativity and the trying to make sense of how does this happen. He's using the imaginary vacuum cleaner to think about, I'm observing this natural phenomenon. How does it happen? And he's not ready for chlorophyll. So he's making it up, but his mind is inquiring. They're very good for giving self-advice. There was one imaginary friend named Deborah who lived in a jewelry box. Whenever this little girl whenever she would have trouble with something, she would ask her parents, but parental advice wasn't always good enough. So she would open the jewelry box and she would ask Deborah what to do. And they would try to problem solve together how to solve this particular problem, usually a social problem. And the other is, if I could get technical just for a minute, because I think it's important. Imaginary friends help develop creativity and nonlinear thinking. There are two kinds of intelligence. There's what we call crystallized intelligence, which is what we know. It's facts, how we're taught, how things work. And then there's fluid intelligence, which is problem solving. And how do we use what it is we know? And with imaginary friends, we try all kinds of things out that make no sense. You're not connecting A to B to C. You're connecting A to Y to 3 to K to Q. And you're trying to think in new ways.
But the linear thinking is another way, right?
The linear thinking is another way, but most creativity comes from making the links, putting the dots together in a way that's not logical. They would come up with something new.
Does this mean that more creative kids are the ones who are likely to have imaginary friends, or that this creative spark is in every kid and this is one way that it comes out?
I believe the latter. I think there's creativity in different degrees, creativity in all of us. And this is one way that it can come out.
These are not necessarily future psychologists or screenwriters?
No, but they might be.
Now, how can these imaginary friends be detrimental? It sounds like they're wonderful. I would like one right now.
Later, I'm going to talk about our adult imaginary friends, because actually we have them. It's rarely a problem. When they're a detrimental imaginary friend is very rare. But there are some warning signs where an imaginary friend is maybe a sign of some developing problem. And that would be if they become truly persecutory, not just mean and nasty, but really harsh. And if real living peers gradually become less real than the imaginary friends. And then we have a developing kind of pathology and a pulling away from the world. Those are warning signs. But aside from something like that, there's really very little downside to imaginary friends. Those two things you really do have to be aware of, but they're quite rare.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on imaginary friends.
For an audio CD of any Parents Perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Mark Nemiroff about children's imaginary friends. Are there some kinds of children who are more likely than others to have imaginary friends?
Yes, and it's not what we all think. It's not the lonely children. It's not the only children. They tend to be the extroverts and the socially engaged children. This is from research. They're not typically linked to loneliness, to shyness, to social problems. It's not what you'd expect at
all.
No,
you're surprising us.
No. It's in kids who are really engaged with the world. And so they're just adding more to make the world even more interesting.
Are there certain ages or developmental stages where this is more likely to happen?
Most imaginary friends begin around toddlerhood, two-ish, three, two and a half, through about age 7 when they die or they move away. But older kids have them, and adolescents, especially girls who keep a diary, have them because the girls treat the diary as a person. Mm-hmm. It's real. They're talking to a real thing. That book that they're writing in is a real thing. That's a form of imaginary friend expressed at a later age. Blogging is aimed at both real people and imaginary people. People who have a blog have an imaginary audience that they've constructed who they think is going to be reading this and contributing to it. Well, these are imaginary friends. The choreographer Paul Taylor developed one of his great dances while conversing with an imaginary friend.
How do you know that?
I was doing a little bit of research before coming on today because I wanted to be sure that I was up to date and if I could find something really interesting, and I was really taken aback by that. That's mm-hmm. relatively recent. He's 80 years old. So So even geniuses have imaginary friends. And if I could bring up a brand name, Harry Potter. Adults who are themselves enchanted with Harry Potter, and there are a lot of us, are often delighted with the imaginary creatures. And not just so they know what their youngster is reading, but they're themselves delighted with the impossible powers, with the potions, with the animals. This is in addition to those books' clear emphasis on values and ethics besides that. So that I was in an airport and I was holding my copy of whatever the latest Harry Potter was, and so was a woman who was clearly a grandmother, and she looked and she said, "I have to read this very quickly because I stole it from my grandson, and by Monday he's going to find out."
That's interesting. Then there's almost like a thread in literature for children and for adults of this kind of being that comes in. I'm thinking of Star Wars and The Wizard of Oz and
yes.
all the way back and back and back.
Yes.
So it sounds like it almost speaks to something that's in the human condition. Forget about ages and stages then.
Yes, I think completely. And The Wizard of Oz, it's obviously a story, so it's someone's imagination, but it's about a girl who actually brings the people from her reality into an imaginary place with her. And that story has worldwide appeal. I was in the Beijing airport and I was about to get lost, which is easy. And so I asked for help. And this lovely Chinese woman pointed down at the different colored footprints on the, and she said, "Follow the yellow brick road."
Oh my goodness.
That's where you're going.
Oh, my goodness.
So the appeal, the imaginary appeal. So even as adults, we're thinking about The Wizard of Oz and the delight of that.
So it doesn't mean that a child is living in a fantasy world.
No. In normal children, they're well aware that these are imaginary friends. They may not say that right away, but they know that their friends, these imaginary friends, aren't real. It's just fun to pretend they're real. They're sometimes worried that the grown-ups don't get it. So one patient of mine, because I was taking the imaginary friend very seriously, because it was interesting and he was telling me a lot about himself, he said, "Dr. Mark, you do know that my magic green chicken is pretend, right?"
Oh, how cute that is.
The magic green chicken would tell this youngster where the magic green eggs with superpowers were hidden.
Oh, did you say you understood?
I said, "Don't worry, I understand."
What kinds of advice would you give to parents of children with imaginary friends besides going ahead and looking for the green eggs?
Oh, I wish we could find them. I really liked this question. The most important thing is to enjoy your child's imagination and not to worry about it and don't overinterpret it and just observe it, ask about it, and have a good time with it. Learn about your children's feelings from them. Don't let imaginary friends become your child's primary friends. This is rarely a problem, but you don't want that to happen. But still, respect the existence of the imaginary friend. Setting a place at the table is fine. The little girl who thought that she was Big Bird had to have a second place set that had bird seed on it at the table every night. There's nothing wrong with that because the imaginary friend is really a part of the child. So what it has to say is important and interesting. And you can ask as part of the dinner conversation, you know, well, what does Bird have to say about that? What is Deborah thinking about that? And don't let your youngster shift the blame from himself to the imaginary friend. Bernice didn't really do it. And one youngster's imaginary friend was named Ditta. And I thought that, well, that's unusual. That it's sort of cute. But it really was for the following sentence. Ditta did it. So the response is not to deny the imaginary friend, but to say, well, even if Ditta or Bernice made the mess, it's your room and it's your responsibility to clean it up. You can say maybe Ditta or Bernice can help you.
I love that suggestion.
Yes.
The main point I want to convey in all of this is to treasure your child's imaginary friends, both for how they enrich your child's life, but they will enrich your knowledge of your child. You'll also have a good time.
I wish we had had those.
I know.
It's funny, I don't recall any of my children having imaginary friends. Unfortunately, I think that would have been fun. But I was in a gym dressing room where I overheard a conversation among several much younger women with young children. And the one was telling the others the story of her children and the tooth fairy. Her older child had lost teeth before, and her second child was just on the brink of losing a tooth. And so the mother explained that the tooth fairy would come and get the tooth out from under the pillow and leave a treasure, a special treat of some sort. So don't worry about the tooth falling out. You'll grow a new tooth. And the child said, "No, no, I don't want anyone in my room. Don't let the tooth fairy come to my house." And then another time, the child brought it up. The child brought up the issue several times. The older child wanted to tell him that it was just pretend, that the tooth fairy was just pretend, and the mother wouldn't let him do that. But he did bring it up several times and asked, "How will the tooth fairy know when I lose my tooth?" And the woman had this elaborate story about how the tooth fairy has a computer and she knows everything that goes on. And it went on and on. There were many details. And finally, the kid starts with, "Don't let that person in. I don't want that lady in my room.
A strange lady.
Don't let that strange lady in my room." And so she said, "Well, it'll be okay. The tooth fairy is very kind and very nice, and it's a good idea because then you get a present." "No, don't let that person in my room." So Sandy and I began to talk about that, and we realized, you know, that's kind of an imaginary friend, too, and children learn that it's just pretend.
But the real world has come in with the stranger danger kind of stuff.
That's so true. In today's world, children are more afraid of a stranger coming into their bedroom.
So what are we doing to their imagination?
If they create that stranger, maybe it's okay. Okay, well, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue some of these issues further? You obviously were able to do some research. How can they?
I was trawling the net, and I'm not sure I would advise that, but I came upon two books that I think are really good. One is Marjorie Taylor, Imaginary Companions and the Children Who Create Them, and John Marco and Martin Greenberg, Imaginary Friends.
Well, this has certainly not been a flight of the imagination. This has been wonderful. We've had a great time, as usual. And so, Dr. Mark Nemiroff, thank you for being with us today and helping us to understand children's imaginary friends.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of one of Dr. Nemiroff's books. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that you possibly can. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 444 and tell us, if you can, what station you are tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Clayton Turner. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.